Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're continuing our ongoing exploration of the cultures of consciousness. And I know one of my formative experiences in exploring the various realms that human creativity and the exploration of consciousness can take you was the Burning Man Festival, which most people have heard about at this point in the game. And I was very lucky because I found out about it in a very peculiar way, and I had absolutely no idea of what it was. And it was way back in 1994. Where I was on a couple of peculiar listservs that were devoted toward weird art and alternative spirituality and anarchism, et cetera. And I was going to be traveling in the west of the United States. I was about to return to California after 10 years on the East Coast. And I just got this little announcement about this quote-unquote arts festival in Nevada. And with knowing nothing more than that, My girlfriend at the time and I went to this event, and it was remarkable partly because I had absolutely no idea what it would be. And we drove off of the road onto this immense salt flat, came across a single crusty character. It looked like he walked off of a, you know, Road Warrior set with a pith helmet and a scowl, and we gave him $20 or something, and he pointed towards a mountain that was, you know, 100 miles away, hundreds of miles away, and said, you go see that mountain, drive towards that mountain for 10 miles, and then make a right. So that's what we did, and then we came across this amazing, marvelous experiment, scruffy, bizarre, completely unimaginable, in the middle of this incredible landscape of nothingness. And I was privileged to be able to go to this event for most of its years since then, and it's been a remarkable experience. And one of the remarkable things about it was meeting some incredible characters. And the following year I was at Burning Man in 95, I wrote an article about it, which was good because it forced me to go around and talk to lots of folks. And one of the people I met there was the fellow we're going to talk to today, Mr. John Law, co-founder of the event and a longtime provocateur of the imagination here in the Bay Area. And most of the time, as folks know, the voice of the Burning Man event is the famous Stetson-wearing Larry Harvey. And so I'm really happy that we can have another angle on the event, as well as talking to John about lots of the other stuff that he's done. But before we get to him, I want to bring on our co-host, Miss Maja from Los Angeles. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thanks. How are you?
You've never been to Burning Man, have you?
I've never been to Burning Man. I'm so embarrassed. It kind of freaks me out a little bit. Like, I would hear a lot. I know, it's like, freak me out. What? I heard a lot of stories from friends of mine about their experiences at Burning Man. And it was, like you said, like, just pretty much, mind-blowing stuff that was, pretty strange, a little odd. And I'm not afraid of strange or odd, but there's a lot of kind of risque activities that have been known to go on at Burning Man. And
I don't know what you're talking about.
I get kind of hermity about going to big festivals like that anyway, because I can't handle people like touching me and stuff in crowds, because I'm really weird.
That's funny, but actually at this point I think you should be proud. I think it's sort of like not having a tattoo. You know, your version of going to Burning Man is having never gone to Burning Man.
Right, I'm a Burning Man virgin, yes.
So let's bring on Mr. Law. John, thank you so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, you're very welcome, Eric. Thanks for asking me to come on out. So I don't know what you want to talk about first, but we could start at any any point in this weird career.
Yeah. Usually on this stuff, I like to start out where people kind of begin, and I know that you got your well, I'm sure we can go back into the misty days of childhood, but it's for our purposes today. I would say you really got rolling in the Bay Area when you showed up, I think a teenager even, and talk about the crew that you encountered then and the whole Suicide Club experience.
Yeah, I will. I came here to San Francisco in June of 1976, the bicentennial year. I was 17. I hitchhiked here after skipping juvenile probation and running away from home, and ended up sleeping in Golden Gate Park for a couple of weeks and panhandling on Market Street and drinking coffee at the Sacred Grounds Cafe and the Blue Unicorn, which were on Hayes Street. Sacred Grounds is still there. The hippies are still there. Some of them have been there ever since. And that was a pretty cool thing, pretty cool place to come to for a 17-year-old who needed to get out of the Midwest and the South and be in a place where, you know, some creative things to pursue rather than just criminal activities. And I stumbled into this group about a year later, about 9 months later, called the San Francisco Suicide Club at its inception. And it was a group that was put together by a fellow named Gary Warren and a couple of other folks, and it grew out of the old, it was kind of had a hippie influence in it, and it grew out of the old free school movement of the late 60s and early 70s. And Gary had been a student administrator for the free school community at SF State, and he and his cohorts got tired of the strictures they were under at SF State, so they took the community, this free school, out and made it into a nonprofit, which was a fairly easy thing to do at the time. And then they would just have people come in, teach free classes, and other people would take the free classes. Everything was free. The classes would range from anything to very practical and interesting things to just silly, completely ridiculous and absurd events. And that was going on for some time, and then he kept doing more and more extreme events, more dangerous or at least soul-searching and frightening sorts of events. And he decided to take that strain out of the community and put it into a private organization that people would have to find out about to join. And so he and Adrian Burke and David Warren and Nancy Prussia started a group called the Suicide Club. They did it. The initiatory event for them was going down to the Golden Gate Bridge underneath on the south side at the Fort Point, holding onto a giant old sea chain that was along the top of the seawall during the middle of the biggest storm of 1977, on January 2nd, 1977, and they got hit by these giant waves that hit the seawall and then crashed down upon them. They hung onto the chain, and that experience, I mean, if you'd let go of the chain, you'd be dead. You'd be swept out to sea, never to be seen again. And so they hung on, and afterwards they sat around and decided they wanted to create a group or a club that would offer that kind of intense experience for intrepid fellow, you know, humans. And they did. They started the Suicide Club based on a story of the same name by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Well, we'll talk about that a little bit, because that's kind of an interesting point, that one of the things about finding out more about the Suicide Club is, on the one hand, there was clearly this quest for, you know, the closest you could get to just pure, unmediated, unpredictable experience. You know, like put yourself in an extreme situation. And I'd love to talk about some of the other examples there. But at the same time, there was a sense of reflection about it. It wasn't just a complete balls out, like, let's just be anarcho weirdos.
No, it wasn't an extreme sports spasm or anything like that. There was a lot of thought behind it. Not necessarily from all of the participants. there was a whole range of people who got involved, but Gary was the primary influence at the inception of that club, and his philosophy, which he had developed over some years, included influences from all kinds of different areas. I'd say some of the biggest ones were weird fiction, the surrealists and Dadaists, weird art movements in the early 20th century, adventure fiction, B movies. A lot of horror movies had big influence aesthetically, much like earlier horror stories and serials had an influence on the surrealists and the Dadaists. So he had those influences, and he incorporated those into the Suicide Club. And some of the people that joined the club shared some of his interests. I had an interest in weird fiction at the time. My friend Don Heron, who was one of the original members of the club, also had a big interest in weird fiction and in detective fiction, particularly San Francisco detective fiction. And those things had a big influence on the events that the club would mount later. So we just basically, this group the way that Gary structured it and his associates structured it was such that anyone could list an event or create an event that they of any type that they wanted. And typically, you know, they'd be encouraged to base it on their personal interests or on their fears, importantly. And we ended up having a range of type of events, and I have to break them down into four or five categories. One would be street theater, which we did. And the street theater was for us. We weren't performers. There were no or few professional performers anywhere near the group. So the street theater was frightening to us to do. It was a big revelation or a big fear challenger for people to go out and do performance, particularly myself. We'd do explorations of abandoned or just weird environments. We'd explore cemeteries, abandoned buildings, of which there were many in the Bay Area at the time because of the huge recession we had been in and the downturn in the manufacturing sector, big old giant abandoned breweries. We'd do these big events in them. And they weren't shows. We didn't charge money. We didn't have an audience. We were the audience, and we were also the participants. So I guess this owed a little bit to the Diggers philosophy, the old hippie Diggers philosophy of living your life as though you were, you know, a character in a story or a movie. It certainly owed something to that, although it was never vocalized that I recall by Gary, but it's something that I've read about since then that seemed to have some similarities.
Did you guys have ladies too, or was this an all dude club?
Games, elaborate games on the streets of San Francisco. Just describing one briefly that was pretty elaborate and very engaging was one of the many detective games that Don Heron mounted. And he's a fellow that does the Dashiell Hammett walking tours locally, which are now the oldest literary walking tour in the country, and started as a Suicide Club event. But he would do these really elaborate games based on extrapolations on fictional characters and people coming up with their own characters. We'd play them out on the streets of San Francisco with fake guns and kidnapping people from, you know, buildings on Geary Street at midnight and just having, you know, weird encounters in the docks and things like that. And they're very engaging. And if you let your mind go and allow yourself to enter into that world, it could be a very transcendental kind of thing for you. And particularly for me, I mean, I joined this group when I was 18, and I was a juvenile delinquent on the lam. And it opened the opportunities for me to be involved in a world of adventure, mystery, and excitement without doing anything immoral or unethical. Because as a kid, I mean, we used to steal cars and break into houses, and I never really thought about the impact of that on other people. It was just exciting to do it. So for me to find a thing like the Suicide Club was brilliant and maybe saved my life. It gave me outlets, a creative outlet for these energies. And a lot of people in the group, I think, had a similar interest. Other people had different interests in it. It was a small group, and we dissuaded or discouraged publicity. There were a couple of articles written about it at the time, and then we quite literally wouldn't allow people to write about it after that. We wouldn't give them any information. And we were approached by several journalists. But we didn't do that because a lot of the stuff we were doing was illegal. I guess the thing that the club became best known for were feats like climbing the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge, which are way easier than they sound at that time. You couldn't get away with doing them now because of the post-9/11 security. But at the time, it wasn't that difficult for somebody who could climb a little bit. And you could actually climb those bridges if you were in just halfway fit shape because you go up on ladders inside them. And there are different ways that you could get onto the towers to get into the shafts and go up the ladders. But we were pretty well known for that. And because of that type of activity, we didn't want to be...
Spur, because I know that you have a long-standing interest in bridges and climbing.
I'm sorry.
What was that you discovered at the time?
What was that, Eric?
Was that something you discovered at the time?
I'm sorry, I missed that first part. What was something that we discovered at the time?
Oh, climbing the bridges.
That was one thing that climbing the bridges was one thing that that was such an exciting idea or concept. I and a couple of other people had been doing a little bit of urban climbing before that, and then it was such an audacious idea. But we were emboldened by the group, by this whole group. Synthesis or whatever you want to call it. I mean, we felt like we could try to do something like that and maybe even get away with it. So we did go out and the first forays were tentative. I mean, we went out to Yerba Buena Island and tried to get out to the stanchion on the cantilever span of the Bay Bridge. That was kind of the first time that I remember going out. And then we went out and climbed around on the Golden Gate headlands, the Marin headlands right next to Lime Point and the Golden Gate Bridge. And then we figured out a way to get up on the box beam underneath the roadway. And eventually, and then finally a fellow named Peter Field and I went out to the tower on this box beam 200 feet out over the water, at dirt and then water. And then And then we figured out a way to get in the tower. And basically over the course of about a month or two, we figured out how to get in the towers and start climbing up inside the towers. And it took a while to find, because it's a honeycomb of shafts inside the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge and other steel bridge towers made at that time. There's a certain construction type or an engineering plan that they worked on, and it was cellular construction for the towers. So on the Golden Gate Bridge, there were only a couple of shafts that actually went to the top, because all the other outer shafts kind of dead-ended or just didn't continue all the way through, or didn't cross over to the one that did open up on the hatchway on the top. So it took us a while to find out how to get up there. We weren't climbing cables because that was visible. I'm sorry, it's hard to hear you there.
Okay. I was just curious, John, if there was any girls in the group, or was this like a fraternal kind of group?
The male-female ratio was about probably 60-40, guys to girls. Two of the founders of the group were women, Adrian Burke and Nancy Prussia. Louise Jaramillowitz, Jean Machofsky. There were some really tough, kick-ass girls in the group. And
wow.
Also some thoughtful, sensitive ones. But
talk
I don't know if that answered your question.
What was an event that really pressed your buttons, where your fear, or whether, you know, in performance or whatever, was really tested?
Well, that's an interesting question for me, because the climbing things, which did kind of frighten most people, because they just didn't, you know, they weren't climbers or they weren't familiar with heights. They didn't bother me at all, because I had been a good natural climber since I was a kid, and I wasn't afraid of heights at all. It was more the socially frightening or embarrassing events that really pushed my buttons. A big component of the Suicide Club was interested in exploring sexuality, and the Suicide Club en groupe ended up infiltrating, quote-unquote, or joining or going to a variety of different sex activities at the time, including swingers clubs and underground sex clubs, orgy circuit, that kind of thing. And I went on a couple of those, and I found them really disturbing and a little frightening, and not that much to my taste. But the one that really scared the piss out of me was getting naked on the cable cars, which was a stunt event that Nancy Prussia came up with. And there were about 30 of us that got together, and a lot of us spent the night at her house beforehand to get ready to go out. And we went out on a Sunday morning to catch the first cable car coming out of the barn, all wearing, like, raincoats or, you know, cloaks or whatever, so we could easily disrobe. And I felt like we were going to... I can't even explain it. I had knots in my stomach. I was sweating. I felt so uncomfortable and frightened about doing this. And then we actually went out and did it, and it was an incredible relief, because early morning, you know, a bunch of little Chinese ladies walking to work with little bags, and they didn't even look at us. It's like, hey, look, there's a bunch of naked guys and whatever, you know. And so it was a revelation for me, and it helped me to get to the point where I wasn't as uptight or frightened about performing or speaking in public or that kind of thing. The other one, which wasn't technically an event, but it was definitely a Suicide Club related exercise, was when we pied Charles Colson, and who was Richard Nixon's chief of staff, and he had been in prison, God had visited him and told him that he was a chosen fellow who should start a ministry, which he did. He wrote a book called True Believer, or True Faith, or I can't remember the name of the book anymore, but he was speaking at the Gold Room in the Fairmont Hotel early morning to the Young President Society, and we went there. My associate, who I can't name, who's a prominent local figure now, was very interested in Pine Colson. He didn't like the whole Nixon thing any more than most people, and so I went along to assist him. And we got our pies, chocolate cream pies from Aaron's Bakery, and showed up, and my pal pretended to be, or actually was a journalist, and, you know, actually pretended he wanted an interview with Colson. He ended up getting the interview, and in the course of that whole thing, ended up pieing the guy. It's a much longer story, but with a lot of nuance. But it was a really, I felt like we were there to assassinate him. I mean, I was in a suit, tie, and my girlfriend with me. We were fans. We were there with one of the books to have him sign it. That was our reason for being there. And I was sweating, cold sweat, stomach tied up in knots. I felt sick. I felt like I was going to throw up. And it was just like we were going to assassinate him. I was just going to hit him with a pie. And I only had the backup pie. It wasn't even the primary. So that was really an eye-opener for me, and I'm glad I did it once. I would never want to do it again. Getting naked on a cable car, whatever, who cares? I mean, it was a fun event to do. It was a real groundbreaking thing for a lot of people, but, you know, I mean, at a certain point, you're past these little introductory experiences and move on to other things. But that's what the Suicide Club was for so many people.
What did Gary think that he was, like, what was the goal, if you could articulate it? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people came with their own, you know, desires and experiences, and partly being open to that was part of what it was about. But, I mean, if you had to sort of, you know, was it just to push the boundary? Was it to actually challenge the limits of reality, the limits of the self? I mean, it's such an interesting kind of creativity. It doesn't really fit in any typical genre. It's not quite performance. It's not quite politics. It's more than a prank. It's hard to almost say what it is. But he must have been, as you said, it was very thoughtful as well as being very intense and exploratory. What was the drive?
Well, everything that you just said was part of what the drive was. Everything, single thing that you just mentioned. We would have events where we, one of my favorite events was lock yourself in a room and see if you agree, where you'd pick the most loaded topic you could think of. Everyone would agree that they'd lock themselves in a room until they agreed to disagree about what they agreed about. I don't know how to better put it. In other words, they'd lock themselves in a room until they completely understood the other position. You'd take a hot button topic like gun control, or abortion, or just something really extreme. And the conversations, and these events were more extreme than climbing the bridge or, you know, like sneaking around in an abandoned building. And they were really, really disturbing in a lot of ways, because you ended up having to face your own prejudices and your own misinformation if you really didn't. People would be in a room for like 10, 12 hours. It was kind of an interesting event. But Gary, I thought about this a lot, and it's a good question. He was, to date, the only true comprehensive visionary I've ever worked with, and I say that unconditionally. I've worked with other people who have done some interesting things and amazing things, and people like Mark Pauline with SRL, Survival Research Labs, who I admire completely, who I consider to be a narrow scope visionary. He's definitely had a vision for machine art and promoted it and done things. But as far as like people who really changed the world in emphatic ways, even though no one's ever heard of the guy. I mean, I'd have to put Gary on that list, because he was really, every event that he did, and then he'd move on to another event, was an eye-opener for people, and some of them, you know, ended up becoming, you know, entire movements at some later date. It's bizarre how this seems to have worked out. But all those ideas, I realized later that he was trying to learn about himself. I never thought that at the time. I thought he was doing these events for other people or for, you know, philosophical reasons or scientific reasons. All of that's true, but primarily I realize now, 25, 30 years later, with some experience in life, that he was trying to find out who he was by doing this stuff. And that was a revelation to me. It's one that I came to pretty recently, actually. I was like, well, Jesus, that, of course that makes sense. He was 35 when he died. He did all this stuff in his 20s and 30s. He was, you know, he was searching for the meaning of himself and being here on this planet. What the hell does all this mean? And that's I'm pretty certain that was the primary central motivating factor for my friend in doing all this stuff. I mean, the stuff that he did, like Suicide Club, was completely believed in not damaging or disrupting or changing the environments we went into. And we went into really interesting environments. Some of them, abandoned industrial sites, you know, bridges where people would work there during the week, cemeteries, and we had a philosophy which came from Gary about not changing the environment at all. Don't pick anything up, don't leave nothing, don't, you know, taggers, none of that crap. It's like we were borrowing that environment, and we were there, and there was a kind of a sense of I don't know what the right word would be about it. I mean, grace is almost too. I can't even describe it, but it was a real feeling that we were in these special places that maybe weren't supposed to be in at the time, and because of that, we should respect the places that we were in, whether they were natural environments or man-made environments. And that's something that carried through into events down the road in the future, which I and other people from the Suicide Club helped to put together. That's a philosophy that's a very strong one. And,
I want to get to that, but I want to stay just for a moment, because one of the other things that really stays with me from hearing about the Suicide Club and your experiences and even the literary inspirations of it is it had a lot to do not just with pushing the self and with challenging internal boundaries, but it also had to do with a certain sense of atmosphere, of environment, that there's a kind of power and a kind of experience that unusual environments can produce, as simple as going down into a sewer or an abandoned work site or even a spectacular point of nature during a storm or whatever, where there's a sort of intensity in the environment that pushes our boundaries, and it's that's another aspect of it that seems to be really fresh in terms of a lot of the, if you look at like engagements in public art and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I would definitely say so, and that brings to mind the concept of the genius loci, which was a concept that Gary definitely was aware of, and that other people in the group were aware of and influenced by, which is the idea that a place has a spirit of some type, some nature, some combination of who knows what, if ephemeral memories from what happened there before, and the spirit of nature that might be there, the interaction of those things create the spirit. And we, although it wasn't vocalized that much, I'd say that the Suicide Club had a view of the place that we went into much that way. There was a spirit of the place that we were in, and not to damage or to insult that spirit. And I think that informed the group quite a bit, actually. And that came from, there's several writers that, I mean, you and I have talked before about writers, and we have love for some mystical writers, fiction writers, the early 20th century, late 19th century. And Arthur Machen was one of them, who he wrote a lot about the sense of place or the spirit of place. And he was one of Gary's favorite writers. He actually, Gary turned me onto that writer. I had never read him before. He was a Welsh mystic and a son of a vicar in rural Wales, and wrote these incredibly beautiful, beautifully crafted stories, all of which had a sense of otherworldliness. And that certainly was one of the influences in the Suicide Club, there's no question. But then again, also was Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. So was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, very big influence on that group. Other movies and other literary things that I had very little or no interest in, but which influenced other people intensely and influenced them to create events of their own that then they shared with other people. So that was the magic of that group, is that in the early days of that group, everyone was encouraged to do an event based on their own desires and their own fears. And most people did. In the first year or two, I'd say most people, almost everyone created an event. And actually one of the characters in the group, who I can't mention by real name because he's a mental health professional around here that people know, but his stage name or handler, Suicide Club name or whatever you want to call it, was Harry Haller. I think he took it from literature, or Hermann Hesse, I think. But Harry decided that not enough people were doing events, so he created a thing called the Patchwork Quilt Event, where basically it was an entire, like, full-day event. Everyone who showed up, and this would be between 7 and maybe 14 people, depending, he did it many times, would do a mini-event. They were encouraged to bring, if they needed them, a prop or an idea about where to go, and the whole group would help them create their fantasy in the real world. And it was a really brilliant mechanism for getting people who were maybe a little bit shy or not used to implementing their ideas in the real world in a group setting, and encourage them to go ahead and do that. And a lot of those people really got so much out of that. One friend, Bill Castura, who went on to be an architectural historian of some note after his initial interest in the Suicide Club of abandoned buildings, because we would sneak into abandoned buildings to do events, and he developed a love for these buildings. He started studying them, reading them, and ended up being Caltrans historian, and had a bunch of other positions in local architectural history, wrote books on architectural history of San Francisco. And I believe that he initially got that, was influenced or, to take off in that direction, to really step into his love for this obscure field through challenging his fears in the Suicide Club. There's a couple of other really prominent folk I could mention, who, some not by name, who I think ended up taking career paths. They might debate this or they might not, I don't know. But I think they were definitely influenced in their career paths by stuff that they did challenging their fears in the Suicide Club. One of the things we like to do is to, quote-unquote, infiltrate cults and weird groups. And that was a very interesting endeavor, because you'd end up learning things about these strange groups that had a lot of people had a lot of ideas about what they were about, and actually going and staying with them and pretending that you wanted to join, you could actually find out when they let their hair down a little bit what they were really about. I mean, I guess the best known of those, which I've talked about before, is the trip to the Moonies, the Unification Church, where we went and spent 3 days with them. Pretty intense 3 days. The other one
and
of those.
What did you find out that you were surprised by there? Like, what was it that was most like, wow?
Well, with the Moonies, you know, I think I was mostly surprised by the fact that that they could actually, you could go in there with your eyes wide open into this group setting, separate yourself from the world, go to their camp retreat, a place called Camp K up in Calistoga, be there for 3 days with your eyes completely wide open, really having read about them, having known a little bit about their recruiting tactics and the accusations against them for being a cultic mind control group and all these sorts of things. You could be there, and after 3 days, they had befuddled you to the point where you could no longer, in certain ways, think logically. Now, they didn't brainwash us and make us join the cult and start, you know, like worshiping Reverend Moon or anything. However, after 3 days, we were confused enough that they could run some completely bogus stories on us, which we didn't have the critical mind to really deconstruct or understand as baloney at the time they were giving it to us. It's a really long story to describe how they put that over on us. But just let me say, I mean, I was really surprised afterwards when we were when we got together after the event and we're talking about it and cross-referencing stories, because five of us went to stay with them, and we all pretended we didn't know one another. And so we all had different stories, and once you start cross-referencing stories after the fact, you learn things, which we did. And it was a revelation. It was definitely bizarre, really. They had told us these stories towards the end of the trip there, and we didn't know that they had to be completely lies, simply on the logical breakdown of the facts. Or the
that's amazing. It's like
stories.
It's like you know, almost like cult as you know, psychoactive substance. It's like, you know, you get the closer you get to it, your normal faculties begin to devolve. But we got to take a break right now. We're going to listen to a couple promos, and then we'll get back and talk about Burning Man.
Okay,
so we'll be back in just a minute. Okay.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Hello! Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Ever wonder why some people have successful lives? Well, let's shrink about this. Hi, I'm Dr. Molly Barrow, author of Matchlines for Singles and the Malia and Teacup self-esteem building series for children. Please join me and my guests every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to explore psychological and practical problem solving, from personal issues to world events. You can call in to join the conversation or just enjoy listening. If you're looking for balance in your relationship, career choices, family, and your planet, please join Dr. Molly Barrow and Shrink About This Tuesday at 10 Eastern on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman. I invite you to join me every Monday at 2 p.m. to listen to What Women Must Know, a show with a purpose: to empower women with truthful information and in-depth, honest, candid conversations regarding holistic solutions for their bodies, their hormones, and pertinent life issues. So that's 2 p.m. every Monday on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. We're here on the Progressive Radio Network with Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. Our guest is John Law of Burning Man. And John, I wanted to ask you a question about the Burning Man, just because for me that's such a powerful symbol. When I was a little girl, my mom used to sew a doll of a man, and every New Year's Eve we would stay up late and we would burn the man of the old year. And so I kind of gone into researching, like in the Golden Bough and in pagan traditions, how they would make these huge effigies of men and burn them, and kind of the symbolism involved in that is a very powerful symbol. So I've always really liked that was kind of like the symbol of that festival that you guys hold there. And I had read a little bit about like some of your parties at Baker Beach, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of like what the symbolism of the Burning Man meant and kind of how you guys came up with that as a representation of your festival.
Sure. Well, first off, I need to qualify a couple things here. First, I haven't been involved in Burning Man since 1996, so I'm not of Burning Man. I'm one of the founders of the festival in the desert, one of the three, and I had a great time doing that. Really enjoyed it, wonderful experience, and a lot has come out of it. And I still work with some people who work on the festival and with the festival, but I have absolutely nothing to do with it. So just to be really emphatically clear about that. There are many great things about what the event is now and other things that I'm critical of, but overall, it's been a positive thing. As far as the symbolism and the historical precedence and the connections between those, you're going to have to talk to Larry Harvey about that. I'm sure he could go on and on and on and on for hours about that. The actual genesis of the real event, however, was pretty much a couple of guys sitting around smoking pot and watching the movie The Wicker Man. And there's a gal named Mary Grauberger who probably in her late 60s now, early 70s, old friend of mine, and she'd been in the Suicide Club. And she was an old hippie gal, or not old at the time, but a hippie gal, and she had a lot of the 60s, mindset, and some of the best things about that period that influenced her. And she started doing a solstice burn on Baker Beach in the early 80s, and burning, she'd invite her friends down, they'd play music, and burn stuff that they brought, and just sort of hang out on the beach. And Jerry James and Larry Harvey, who are the two guys who started Burning Man the first time on Baker Beach in 86, were friends of hers and would go to her, or I went at least once or twice to her solstice event, and got the idea from that and from The Wicker Man to start burning a figure, which they did. Jerry James cobbled together a wooden figure, and they went down with some friends and burned on the beach. And then I got involved with a group called the Cacophony Society, which was an outgrowth of the Suicide Club. The Cacophony Society started in 1986 and was a group of people doing similar things to what the Suicide Club had been doing, but I guess I'd characterize it as a kinder, gentler Suicide Club. The thing that Cacophony became best known for better or worse, was the annual Santa Rampage, where hundreds and maybe even thousands of Santas run around acting silly in different cities around the world just before Christmas time. We started that as an event in 1994 in San Francisco, me and two other guys, Rob Schmidt and Michael. And it was Rob's idea, and Michael and I helped him with the logistics. And anyway, that was what that group became known for. We were doing events in San Francisco at the time, similar to the Suicide Club Underground, non-commercial, non-audience type events. A lot more street theater, I'd say, in Cacophony than in the Suicide Club. And Jerry James, who's doing Burning Man, got in touch with us, started coming on our events, and invited us to help work on the Baker Beach event, Burning Man. We met Larry, and we're all friends, and started working on the thing there, and the event started growing quite a bit, and then we ended up moving it to the desert in 1990 after being shut down on Baker Beach. But as far as the symbolism of the Burning Man is a very powerful archetypal symbol. It's like you can pretty much draw on it whatever you like, which has certainly been done by a lot of people over time. And you can draw history from the ancient mystery cults in Greece and draw whatever parallels that you choose to. And I'm sure there's enough information to footnote it and make it sound, you know, like that was the original idea, but it wasn't. Not in my experience. It was a great event and a very powerful archetypal central symbol that attracted people, because the idea of burning a man, or the essence or feeling of burning a man, is very powerful. Also, very simple. So,
that's one of the key things, and it actually runs through the Suicide Club. It runs through a certain quality of psychedelic prankster. There's a certain point where there's an active resistance to the ascription of a specific meaning. That there's a way of trying to invoke a sense of experience, a quality of intensity, even a symbolic power, but without naming it, without saying this means this or this ritual is for this, almost to like allow people to have their own experiences, their own things to happen, and also to keep it from a certain kind of cheesiness. You know, things get cheesy when you're like, oh, we gather once a summer to burn a man and he will carry our sins, or whatever the crazy story is about it. And there seemed to be something very fresh in this whole thing that you're talking about, where there's a kind of active meaninglessness. Like there's like almost like a cultivation of something that's incredibly meaningful and potentially meaningful for individuals, but that in itself is almost left kind of empty, almost like the desert itself. I mean, you mentioned moving to the desert. Talk about how the desert felt to you. What attracted to you about the Black Rock Desert where you moved the event in whatever 1990?
Well, I knew the Black Rock Desert from being out there a couple times before in the 80s, and I had another friend, Kevin Evans, who was active and involving cacophony events, who had also been out there. And we both found out that we knew the location, we were off like a house on fire, like, oh my God, what a great place, it's fabulous, it's flat, and there's nothing there. Let's do a cacophony event out there. And so we had been organizing, working on doing a summer trip for some time, and concurrent with that, we'd been involved in Burning Man at Baker Beach, and we got shut down in June of 1990, and so it was just, Kevin, I think, first came up with the idea of taking the man along with us on the cacophony event to the desert, which we ended up doing. And, that expanse is, it's just an open palette where, I mean, we felt that way at the time, where you could pretty much do anything at all, anything could happen, and we would never be known of, or it could be a formative experience for you. I mean, there's just no way to know. You could do anything out there. That was the original impetus to put it out there. The other one for me was a dual purpose for putting it in that area. One was aesthetic and one was political. When we first went out there, I chose the location and I put it as far off road as humanly possible. And that would have been up Playa, 10, 12 miles, and then, like I said, hang a right in the middle of nowhere. And the reason for that was because people would be completely disconnected from their normal, average, regular world. I mean, you're literally in nowhere. It could be anywhere. It could be nowhere. There's no road. There's no signpost. There's no connection. There's no touchstone. And the political reason was because even that early on, I knew that the further away, because what we were doing, someone wouldn't like it. no matter what they thought it was or what it really was, somebody wouldn't like it, even out in the middle of nowhere. And I was familiar with rural desert areas. And the further away from people we are, and also another little thing that has conveniently been forgotten in a lot of the histories, the better armed you are, the less likely people are to give you any grief if you're off doing what you want to do in the middle of nowhere. And that what turned out to be the case. We were a fairly well-armed group. We did a lot of shooting events. There were a lot of weapons involved in the early Burning Man. And this is one of the reasons why locals in Washoe and Pershing counties and Humboldt counties kind of got to like us a little bit when we were first out there, some of them, because they could see that we shared this common interest in weapons and in the Second Amendment. And this is something you don't hear about too much, in the Burning Man promotional material that you might have. But that was a big part of the genesis of the event. And that being in the middle of nowhere and that empty space, I love the movie Lawrence of Arabia, and it's basically, a passionate yearning drove them out into the desert. I mean, it's basically that's the best I could describe our desire to go to that place. It just was a natural place to go to do sort of things that we wanted to do and not be bothered. by the time people took notice of us, we had enough, you know, small political clout, and we're making enough money for the local businesses that we actually had some leverage there, and we, you know, that's been played really, really well by the organization ever since, to the benefit of the people that go to the event, thankfully. I don't know. Is that even beginning?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know it's a big topic too, but just a little bit about whether you believe. I mean, that's, you know, within Burning Man lore, there's this sort of famous year, 1996. 1996, things. The theme was hell or Hellco. You know, it's, Satan's going to come in and buy off Burning Man. And there were a number of really a couple tragic events of that year. That things came to a head. It was a chaos. And subsequently, you left the event. And obviously, this is a complicated story. We don't have time to go into all the details, and that's fine. But I'm kind of curious now where you sit, whether in terms of what you believe was most powerful and important about that event. Is it inevitable that something like that has to, it's impossible to sustain when you get that number of people? It seems like it was partly the growing popularity and the more numbers, and then you had to create more constraints because it was more likely that bad things were going to happen. Do you feel like it's even possible to sustain the kind of spirit that you've been talking about this whole episode with the Suicide Club and the Cacophony Society and early Burning Man? Is it even possible to do it at that scale, at the scale it was becoming?
No, not possible. It's not possible, and this brings to mind another area of influence for the original trip to the desert and the early Burning Man was, and this is also something that's not in the the press kit. A little book called The Temporary Autonomous Zone, written by Hakeem Bey, a fellow named Peter Lamborn Wilson, who used the writer's name, Hakeem Bey. And he had a particular interest in extreme individual freedoms, and wrote a lot about corsairs and pirates, you know, 17th century pirates and freeboot communities, and among other things he's written about over the years. And he wrote this book, Temporary Autonomous Zone, about people individually coming together to create a magical and fabulous community of ideas and activities, and then dissipating into the wind and going away before they could be soiled or destroyed or even necessarily understood or recognized. And that book had a big influence on a lot of the people who were formative in originating the event on the desert, myself included. And you know, the idea of coming to a place and being in a place where, one, the authorities didn't care that much about doing stuff that they'd have to spend time and energy to get to record, which, you know, also you know, with if you understand bureaucracies and governments and police forces, I mean, their primary interest is not getting in trouble. So if you're out doing something and they're not going to get in trouble for it, and they're not going to be, and it's not going to reflect on them, then they're less likely to try and make you do anything, which is how we survived the first few years. Because we weren't as much of a threat. If we'd been doing the event like next to a town somewhere, they would have shut us down immediately. I mean, you know, they just would have. I remember the first year we were out there, we came through town, had breakfast at dawn, drove out. There were maybe 40 people in the caravan, and then another 30 or 40 that showed up later, but 40 of us that drove out in the desert. Rumor went around town after that we were Satanists doing, you know, baby sacrifices in the desert. And after a little while, after getting to know some of the people in town, they realized that was a bunch of hooey. But these are how these stories get started. And sometimes a story like that, if it gets started and, you know, you're right there and they see you doing these bizarre things that, you know, maybe they don't think are supportable, you know, you get some political pressure and you can't, you know, or law enforcement pressure and they shut you down. Well, we were not shut down by them because we were out in the middle of nowhere, and that was a choice. That was a choice. That wasn't by accident. So, I don't know. I'm meandering here. What was the question?
No. It's all fine and good. Good stuff. Well, maybe one thing we could do right now is, you know, I'm going to put on another hat here and let people know that, you know, one of the things that came out of my experience with Burning Man, including being there at the tail end of those early years in 1996 and then watching the event, transform and become more organized, become a more develop more a story about what it meant, but also include more and more people into experiences that, you know, were still quite remarkable and changed, became a different kind of place, became more of a city and less of a temporary autonomous zone, more organized, mm-hmm. but also a kind of fabulous city. But these experiences for me led to working on, of all things, a rock opera based on Burning Man called How to Survive the Apocalypse. And what we tried to do in this event, which we've staged in San Francisco a couple of times and are now trying to make a CD based on, is to give a slice of a more contemporary feeling of Burning Man by telling the story of a couple of newbies who show up and encounter all the weirdos and strange experiences that are, in some ways, you can think of Burning Man as a cross between the goals of the Suicide Club and a theme park, and it's sort of somewhere in between, and where you fall in between depends on your personality and depends on your luck in terms of the kinds of things you stumble across, because there's definitely a theme park side of it. Well, when we did the story, we also wanted to tell some of the history of the event, because to my mind, the history of the event is an incredibly vital story, not just for its interest, but also because of what it tells about the attempt to keep this countercultural, truly engaged spirit of psychological and creative revolt and novelty and refusal alive, even and whether the question is whether you can even have it work on that scale. And so for me, one of the key songs that I wrote the words for the show is this song we call The Clash, and it's a fantasy. It didn't happen like this, but we have our character who's based on Larry Harvey, and our character who's based on John Law have it out over the future of the festival after this sort of tragedy has occurred in our kind of fantasized version of Burning Man. So what I want to do now is just play a short clip of that, just for a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back and talk to John Law. So this is the song The Clash from How to Survive the Apocalypse, and if you're interested in the opera, you can go to burningopera.com, and we're also raising money right now with the Kickstarter campaign, kickstarter.com. Check out How to Survive the Apocalypse, and we're trying to raise money to put this thing out on a CD. So now, if the gods of technology are on our sides, we can hear a little bit of The Clash from How to Survive the Apocalypse.
He's right, you know. It's not happening again. Passionate yearning drew us to this desert, but we've grown too big for our britches.
Passion must move again or die,
and it's time for it to die.
It grows because it's alive. The world is just beginning again. This is a snag, a hitch. The law can be appeased. It's part of the plan. Befriending the man.
It grows because it's alive. It doesn't want to die.
We're cooking up something everybody needs. Why shouldn't they be drawn to our fire?
There's too many damn people. We can't control it without control. Who wants more control?
We are not about rules and regulations. We are the kids in the back of a bus. We will not be bound by the implications. We are the free, gotta stay on the ground.
But not if our numbers grow, we will kill the thing. We rose up from the wreckage.
All right, so that was a little clip from How to Survive the Apocalypse, a tune called The Clash. I suspect that in all of your exploits, John, you probably did not expect that you would be immortalized during your own lifetime.
Well, I have to tell you, it's extremely flattering having a wonderful fellow who's taller and way more handsome than me play me in your play, Stefano Sacks. And he does a great job, too.
Yeah, that was Stefano.
Very flattering, Eric.
Yeah, that was Stefano Sacks doing the John Locke character, and Christopher Fulling, the director of the opera, playing the Larry Harvey character. Stetson,
what a
tenor. And if you want to hear more of that music, please go to Kickstarter and help us raise money to put it out as a CD. But enough of the show. So we have just a few minutes left, Mark. John, and I wanted to ask you, like, we've been talking about this spirit. You've given us incredible, juicy, inspiring images of things that people have done in the past, things that are partly about a certain period in cultural history when certain things were available culturally and even just legally that aren't now, that are foreclosed now. You know, it's a different age. There's the Internet. There's all this different stuff. How do you see, whether it's in your life or whether it's out in the world or other people you know, where does one find that spirit? How do you keep that kind of questioning spirit of a revolt alive in our time now?
Well, you look in the cracks. You look between things. That was a big, an operative element of the Suicide Club, and also later was looking for places that other people don't know, don't care about, don't see. The Suicide Club, we would explore abandoned lots in the city's abandoned buildings, places underneath the freeways, the backs of billboards, just any physical environment that was intriguing. We would go there and try to learn about it, use it for an event, or incorporate it somehow into our ongoing lives through the events that we were creating. And now it's just the same as ever. I mean, you look for places other people don't look at, don't look for, and I don't know where they are. I mean, some 14-year-old kid is going to find them. You know, because they're closer to what's going on than I am. But I don't live in the past. I have a great past, fortunately, both good and bad. And it's a great place to visit, but I don't live there. I'm looking places. I'm spending a lot of time in Michigan and Detroit, because Detroit is a very bizarre place, and it's also an incredible frontier. And it would be the last place anybody would like to spend any time if they just listen to what other people say about Detroit. But I think that those industrial wastelands in this Midwest and East Coast are the new frontiers in a lot of ways for social experimentation and for arts experimentation and all that sort of thing in the upcoming decades. And and despite all the rules and regulations and incredible control factors that have been put in place by our ever-expanding monstrous government and the industries that they're aligned with to keep people from being free. And I just think those places are, you'll find, they're there and you can find them. You always have to take a risk to do anything worth doing. And I've just been really lucky. I mean, I just happen to be in the right place at the right time a bunch of different times. That's how I look at it, hanging out with people doing interesting things and able to contribute in my way to that. The Suicide Club was comprised of people who were pretty normal folks in a lot of ways. They weren't super rock climber, extreme sports people, or actors, or brilliant writers. And there were some fairly regular folks who were opened up to incredible and extraordinary opportunity through this group synthesis that was set in motion. And that sort of thing's always available. I mean, everybody's always. I came into San Francisco in 1976. Everybody told me, they said, "Hey, kid, you missed it. You missed the party. You should have been here 7-8 years ago. Man, just go home. Go back to Tennessee or Michigan right now. You fucking missed it." Pardon my French. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And then within a year, I was in the Suicide Club. Within a year, the punk scene started. The underground San Francisco theater scene at that time was off the hook. There was so much stuff going on. And, you know, unlike the hippies, we were sober. You know, we remember it.
Right. All right, John. With that, we got to those hopeful notes. Look for the cracks and the cracking apart economy of our future. John Locke, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Anytime, buddy.
I'm Eric Davis. Bye, bye, Maja.
Bye, guys.
Bye, Maja.
And
thanks.
Again, check out Kickstarter.
Facebook.com, How to Survive the Apocalypse. Help us put out the CD. All right, bye for now.
Stay tuned for Ask Dr. Eisenstein. The doctor's here to answer your medical anomalies in his own expert opinion. Only here on PRN.
I sure am. Awesome. Absolutely awesome. Thank you.
At 6 p.m. Please join us as we...